Hey there, podcast family. T-Bone here to talk about the 3D Dentist Digital Implant Continuum. Are you ready to start placing dental implants, but feeling a bit hesitant and or overwhelmed? I know that feeling. I've been there. Let's change that together. Imagine not just learning about dental implants in a classroom, but actually performing surgeries on real patients right here in North Carolina, guided every step of the way by our expert 3D mentors. This is dental implant learning at its best, using techniques that are safe, predictable, and confidence-boosting. They're exactly what I use in my own practice, so you know they work. Our course goes beyond clinical skills. We prepare you to successfully integrate high-demand implant services into your practice, transforming your career by attracting new patients and elevating your practice. And it doesn't end with the course. Completing our program is just the beginning of a new journey. You'll be a part of a community of confident, skilled dentists with ongoing support to ensure lasting success and growth. After all, this is about mastering a skill that can transform your career, just like it did for me. So, are you ready to take your practice to the next level? Visit www.3d-dentist.com, check out our upcoming sessions, and join us to revolutionize your practice. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now let's get back to this week's episode. Happy New Year and welcome to the first episode for 2020 of the T-Bone Speaks podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Tarun Agarwal, and this week's episode, we have a very special guest, and I'm actually going to be doing a talk with my brother, Ravi Agarwal, and Sully Sullivan was joining us to kind of get things going. So I want to wish everybody a happy new year. And episode 169 is going to be with Dr. Ravi Agarwal. And as always, I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Miss Meredith Jones.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back and happy 2020. I'm so excited for a big year ahead for everyone, all of you guys, especially everyone at 3D Dentists.
Meredith, we've been having great weather here. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. This is going to be fun. These classes, we're having lunch outside. We're poolside in North Carolina in the winter.
Don't worry. It'll change tomorrow. I'm sure of it.
But we're slammed full. We have classes back to back. We're sold out for all of our January courses. We're into February, March. It's going to be a fun year.
Yeah, it's good. So everybody, so we're going to try to start talking a little bit about what's going on before we get into the episode. And I want to share a story with you guys. My wife made me go to Charleston during our Christmas trip. Sorry, during Christmas break, because I tried to do a staycation and she decided she couldn't do a staycation. And then my son wanted to take the Tesla for some reason. So we had to stop and charge a couple of times. And then I forgot that my Tesla had some older tires on it. So on the way back, my tire blew in the middle of nowhere. And then Tesla tires aren't very readily available. We had to wait for the tow truck. The tow truck wasn't able to get there that night. So then we were able to ask the convenience store owners, who happened to be Indians, to drive us to a hotel like 15 miles away, because where we broke our, where we tire busted, there was no Uber and Lyft service out there. So my wife is a bit angry with me, but 24 hours later, we made it home with four brand new tires on our car. So that was an interesting trip.
I was going to say, why did you leave so late at night?
I wanted to get back to play golf.
Yeah. It's always about the golf.
it's always a little bit self-focused, of course.
We know there's a reason. Well, we just had we did Christmas this year, at the office after you guys got back from Charleston. So that was after Christmas, which is the first time we've done this. It was also the first year everyone from both offices could make it. Yeah. We had a lot of fun. We went shopping.
Yeah. So for this year's, quote unquote holiday party, we took both our offices, my dental practice and my wife's medical psychiatry practice. And by the way, that's 32 team members now between the two. We went to the mall, South Point Mall. We made everybody meet us at Maggiano's because that's where we were going to have afternoon lunch. But then we surprised everybody with a gift card to go shopping at Nordstrom's. And what were the rules?
But Meredith? We had three rules. I think there was three. Okay. You had to spend all the money. You had to spend it on yourself, or you had to give the money back.
That's correct. And then We did have dinner at Maggiano's, and then we had a show and tell episode, show and tell, where everybody showed all their whatever they bought.
Some people tried on, modeled their clothes. Yeah.
Some things were not appropriate to model on, so that was pretty good. So that was a lot of fun. So in this week's episode, we're going to talk about growing up together with my brother and what led him to dental school, what led him to oral surgery residency, what he's doing in oral surgery, he's a program director, and kind of like the challenge or the positives and negatives of being an oral surgeon and working with a general dentist.
I listened to this podcast live. It's a little long, but it's really good. So it's worth it, you guys.
Absolutely. So let's go to this week's episode, episode 169 with Dr. Ravi Agarwal.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the T-Bone Speaks podcast. I am live. I am the new and finer white T-Bone.
Well, I wasn't white to begin with, so
yeah,
I'm actually quite brown.
Yeah, but I'd like to hear what your people would say about that. Like, how white, how brown are you compared to like the real brown people?
I'm probably on the dark chocolate side of brown. And I think you're super outnumbered today because I got my younger brother with me. I have to stop saying little brother because you're not my little brother. We're not like kids anymore.
Yeah, you just got a few inches on me otherwise.
That's what she said.
Now we're talking. All right, guys. As the moderator in this, this is not a measuring contest, all right? So let's go slow. But okay. I'm excited. This will be fun.
Well, you know, I've been wanting to bring him on. I've talked to him about it, and he always says, well, what are we going to talk about? I got nothing to talk about.
What
are people interested in?
And then magically Sully shows up today and just convinces the situation.
Well, so, just kind of pushes
that's
it a little
what I'm
bit.
Here for.
All right, so we're going to bring my younger brother on, Ravi Agarwal, R-Bone, as I like to call him internally. He made a surprise visit to visit the parents, not to visit me, but to visit the parents.
And the kids.
And I think he got bored at home, and it seems he stays with my parents when he comes. He got bored at home and decided that to end his boredom, he would show up at my place. Probably needed some food, to be quite honest with you.
Okay, so here's the deal. Here's kind of where I think we should take this, because I'm the moderator.
Well, I think we need to introduce him at least.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I want to hear from you. I want to hear what you're doing, you know, how you got into this. Because obviously a lot of us have heard T-Bone's story.
Right.
And so I want to hear your side of the story, and I want to hear what it's like having to deal with T-Bone as an older brother as you became your story.
Well, I think people got to understand we were 8 years apart, 9 years apart.
Exactly.
So that plays a big role in it.
So
as well.
We didn't, you know, I left for college when you were what, 5 years old?
Third grade.
So yeah. It's like 6 years old. Yeah,
so then let's do this. Then start back where, you know, when y'all have moved here. Let's go back, you know, towards almost the Rockingham days and mm-hmm. start from there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because my recollection of Rockingham is going to be very different than what he grew up in.
He grew up in the motel.
Well, I did.
We were in a house. You actually lived in a home. I lived in a motel room.
Right. But I still had to deal with, like, I couldn't clean. I didn't get put to work as much as he did.
And when you were five, we moved into a real house in a normal, like, outside the motel.
In a neighborhood, right.
Gotcha.
So,
neighborhood-ish.
Okay. So you still.
Neighborhood-ish.
So I had friends in the neighborhood. So it was a neighborhood for me. But, you know, in the end, it was. It still went through the same phases of growth in a small town, you know. So my parents were in a little better situation. So I got to be spoiled a little bit more than T-Bone was growing up.
I felt pretty spoiled though growing up. I didn't ever feel that we didn't have.
Correct. I agree.
I didn't understand.
It's relative, right?
Well, I wouldn't even say relative. I would say that my parents never made us feel that we didn't have, I just didn't know. I didn't know what Louis Vuitton was growing up.
Sure.
The first time my wife gave me a Cartier wallet, I said, "What's Cartier?" And she proceeded to take it right back from me.
Yeah, she's like, that's a bad idea.
And so I didn't know any of those things. To me, fancy was going out to eat Chinese.
Right.
Mexican was Taco Bell.
Driving 20 minutes to go watch a movie. We didn't have a movie theater growing up. So 30-minute drive, 40-minute drive, we'd go eat Thai food and go watch a movie.
Crazy.
I didn't even get Thai food. I only got Lung Wah Chinese. Shrimp fried rice, extra shrimp.
But ultimately, you know, once he moved out, I went through school. And then I was fortunate to.
What was y'all's relationship back then? It was like, were y'all close or
it was
big brother, little brother?
It was very much big brother, little brother. I was annoying little brother.
You know,
especially in the younger days.
I was an angry teenager.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I get that.
I'm still angry, so.
Oh, God, obviously.
So I learned all my diplomatic skills from him being angry all the time. No, but it was a lot of fun for me because I was just that little brat kind of running around. And but
sure.
Once I got to college, undergrad, and dental school, and I think that's really when our relationship started changing.
Did you, because obviously 8 years means he's finished dental school before you started
dental school.
Yeah. Oh, I finished dental school while he was in high school.
Yeah, I was in high school.
So he was in 10th grade, I think.
11th grade. You're going back.
Between 10th and 11th grade when I finished dental school. So when I moved back to North Carolina, I mean, he's going to 11th grade.
Wow. Right. So did you, at that point, did you like look up to him? Did you think that was 100%. Cool? Or?
Yeah,
100%. He still does, just so you know.
No, bull crap.
But, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, 100% I did. Because in 11th grade, I actually moved out of Rockingham and went to a boarding school in Durham.
Okay.
So I was actually 30 minutes away from him. Wow. So I got spoiled with him. I couldn't have a car in boarding school. So he'd go, at this time, secretly go see Mona and fly down to Florida, and I get the car for the weekend, and I'm like joyriding around with the car. It was great. But that's when my passion, I always thought about dentistry and medicine. You know,
it was force-fed on us to a certain degree.
It was force-fed.
Although not so much in our family, but culturally.
Sure, no, I get that.
Professional school is force-fed.
And we got to see a lot of it.
Was that more from, obviously your dad being a dentist, but was that from was him primarily, or was your mom too?
No, it's just cultural. It's culturally. Culturally that, so look, when you're an immigrant, there's only one way to guarantee moving up, education. Only one way. Okay. And when you're an immigrant, the only one way to guarantee that you will get far in life or have the opportunity to get far in life is to be your own boss. Okay. Mm. So those things were innate in us culturally. So
that's why professional school, specifically doctors, becomes a big one.
Well, any education at this point. So yeah, traditionally you'd be doctor, engineer, but now it's you're going to see the
pharmacies.
You're seeing that expansion.
Professional hotel
owners. To have a skill set is probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So,
you know, so once I kind of fell in love with dentistry when he opened his practice, which was probably 2001.
Right when you graduated high school.
Right when I got to high school, because it was fascinating to me
to look at then.
It was fascinating to me though, because a lot of the conversations there was a marketing conversation. There was a IT conversation. There was an accounting conversation. Now that I could, the only thing I could keep up with him was IT.
Sure.
You know, help him come on the weekends. He'd pick me up. I'd go help set up 5 PCs, go to the PC store and buy stuff. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is gonna be terrible.
But it worked out fine.
But it worked out fine. But that's when I said, you know, this is such an interesting field. I already knew a little bit about it. That's when it really hit me. I said, you're more than just a technician. You really get to see small business. So it hit home to say, all right, this is what I want to do.
So you really, seeing him in practice was somewhat of the big deliver of that. Wow, that's interesting.
And I also love dentistry, right? So sure. I didn't come home and say, I don't want to talk about the office. Or I hate it. I came home and
that's fired up.
Oh, dude, I was in it to win it.
I mean, his brain is now. It's just, it's 24 hours a day he's thinking.
I'm thinking sure. Work, you know, right. Dentistry is my work. So that's what I think. Right. I think the next step constantly.
Okay. Okay. So then you go to dental school.
Right.
And then let's fast forward a little bit.
You lived with me.
Oh, you did during dental
school? Yeah. So my second and third year of dental school, T-Bone lived in Durham. I was in Chapel Hill at UNC. Okay. So I lived with them for those 2 years.
Which was great. Which was phenomenal
wow,
for me
because
I felt like I was then growing up with my brother. Because, you know, he was in 10th grade when I came back.
The 8 years became way shorter. Yeah, exactly.
The difference in, you know, a 24-year-old kid and a 30-year-old kid.
Was a lot smarter.
It's much different than an 18-year-old kid and a 10-year-old kid.
Very
much
so.
So for me, it was awesome to have him living with us, to be able to see him and to be able to, you know, for me to see him go through dental school and to be able to kind of push back like this that they're telling you is not realistic or that kind of stuff.
Right. And that was probably the vast majority of the conversations when I was in dental school.
Yeah, he was argumentative.
I was argumentative, and I would come home and say, listen, my pros guy said this is the way it has to be done.
You have to have this type of inclusion.
Composites are bad in the back. You got to do amalgam. At some point, what would happen is that I remember this vividly. Okay, he'd come to the office to observe while he's in dental school, and while I'm working on the patient, he goes, yeah, that wouldn't work in dental school. They would tell us we would fail if we did that.
Patients aren't sedated.
Yeah. Listen, I didn't have clinical experience at that point, so I didn't know what it meant to talk to a patient.
He would just say, like, on the typodont, that would not work.
Oh, no, that's not going to work. Patient's like, what? Who's this guy?
But it was a lot of fun. But luckily, it wasn't too centered on dentistry, but it was a lot of these, like, question marks is I'd see this side of dentistry that was changing. CEREC, there's a lot of ceramic work, moving away from amalgam. And in dentistry, in dental school, you're still kind of, there's no concept of CAD/CAM.
Right.
Even though it's a known entity.
And it's there.
And it's there.
Well, but at that time, we're talking 03 or 05.
Yeah, but
we're
there.
But you're very progressive amongst private practice people, let alone dental schools. So, I mean, gosh.
And that I learned as well, that what he was doing is probably pushing the boundary a little bit.
Sure.
That was a lot of the conversations. It was very much on not super technical stuff. It was just like, hey, this is what about this? I was like, I remember one time I was like, so what do you think about this nano-filled composite? And then, so that was a conversation. I was like, well, we're using this old stuff still. But
do you use spherical or non-spherical?
Do you even know what that is, Sully?
No.
So the next step was my first, he's disappointed me twice in my life.
Okay.
The first disappointment to me was after he graduated, he wanted to go to oral surgery school. And I was looking for him to join in.
You.
And at that point, even today, I would give him 50%. Like I could never ever take money from him to join in the practice. So I was hoping for that, but at the same time, also proud that unlike me, he actually had the grades and the political power to get into oral surgery residency.
So stop there then. Mm-hmm. So talk about that. How? What was it? Because obviously, you look up to your brother at this point. Things are good.
I'm telling him he should be a general dentist.
He's screaming to be a general dentist. He's trying to do oral surgery stuff as a general dentist.
And then my parents are telling him to go specialize.
So that was some pressure there.
I don't think it was much my parents. Like he mentioned earlier, my parents encouraged further education if it meant it makes a difference.
They just didn't know I didn't have the grades to get in.
I choose to be a GP.
He used to pass out when he saw blood. So surgery was not his calling early on.
Well, the tables have turned.
But it was like middle of dental school. Like, I always had a passion for medicine as well. And so once you got further along in dentistry, I fell in love with oral surgery. I had opportunities to shadow some of his colleagues that he worked with. And then spend time at the dental school. Chapel Hill at the time is still a well-regarded oral surgery program. So I got to see this side of dentistry, oral surgery, that just, it was my calling. That was it.
Wow.
And I solidified it kind of working with one of his friends. And I said, this is it. I'm going to do this. And January third year dental school, I said,
so he comes to you and tells you this, and you're just...
I was like, well, we'll change his mind.
Okay.
Because he's still a believer. Like he does now, and encourages general dentistry to say, you can do a lot of things.
If you learn how to do it.
If you learn and you have the education, right? So he was telling me that as well. It was no doubt that he said, well, if you want to do surgery, you still can do a lot of procedures if you go get the proper training. So go do a GPR that's heavy in surgery.
And my sell to him was, you don't have to deal with any of the business stuff. I'll take care of all of that. You just come and do whatever dentistry you want to do, and we'll have a good time. It'll be great. And my vision was that it was going to be me and my brother working, and my dad being the Walmart greeter in the front, so we could have a family affair.
Happiest man alive.
Dude, my dad would totally do that.
100%. He would kill it.
He'd actually talk to anybody.
He'd wear his Gangle hat and greet you when he walks into the office.
That's fantastic.
But that didn't work. So that was my first disappointment.
Your mom would bring lunch.
Yeah, 1,000%.
It would be the whole office.
In fact, she would probably put a stove in the office and cook fresh every day. This has cost me a lot of money. Him not going to general dentistry because now I gotta,
the family.
I gotta hire people to do that stuff.
Great family business.
And So he went to residency, and you did that in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. So, it's a match process. So, you rank your programs, you go, and I match that. Fortunately, a very program that I really liked. And that 4 years was challenging.
So why did you choose a regular four-year program versus the combined oral surgery with an MD?
It's a big dilemma that I think every applicant to oral surgery goes through, is trying to figure out what value does a medical degree bring. As you said, education means a lot. So I never say
those
that
two letters
and the two letters. Make,
but it's
make
interesting. My
right?
dad didn't. My dad didn't agree with the MD degree because he didn't think it was practical.
Right. So once he understood, so the conversation is like. So he was asking me. He's like, "Well, what does it get me?" I said, "Well, it gets me two letters. Does it change your ability to bill? No. Does it change ability to practice? No. Is it a marketing tool?" I said, "Well, if I come back to North Carolina, no. So if I was in Southern California, yeah, because I think almost every oral surgeon in Southern California is probably a medical degree.
So it can sometimes be dependent, regionally dependent.
Regionally dependent based on the training programs.
But other than that, it's just ego.
Well, I wouldn't say it's
just ego. Well, there's some benefits to it. I mean, if you want to do like facial, if you want to do oculoplastics, if you want to do some of that level of oral surgery, then certainly an MD degree is helpful. Or if you want to be more medicine-based, or if you want to be, you know, more based.
Do you get any privileges that you don't have as a... like hospital privileges or anything like that?
In my experience, no. You know, so from based on, you know, and I work in a hospital now. And I couldn't imagine that changing anything that I do.
Gotcha.
So I think the big benefit is that for those...
You wouldn't do anything differently is what you're saying.
Correct.
Gotcha.
And I think the big benefit to have the medical degree is if I wanted to do a fellowship. So cosmetics, cancer, craniofacial cleft. That's where that you need to have that.
That's good advice. Yeah,
that degree. Yeah. So those are the two things I looked at. One was it's a financial decision because if you go to medical school, you're going to pay for it.
Sure.
So imagine you're already coming out of dental school with, you know, $100,000 debt. Now you're going to medical school.
$400,000. That's people laugh at you. $100,000 in debt.
Well,
$150,000 in debt.
$150,000. I was fortunate. Chapel Hill is a great place. It's $150,000.
It's funny, by the way, that I came out with no debt other than my gambling debt, and he came out with debt. It's a very, very good story, because so culturally. If your parents, if they have the ability, will pay for your education in our culture, at least, and certainly in our family. So
stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast family, T-Bone here. Are you a dentist looking to elevate your practice and profits? Then pay close attention. Introducing the 3D Business Mastermind, the dental business coaching program designed for dentists who want to see real results. I've walked the path of practice ownership for nearly 25 years. I know your challenges. I felt your pain. This is your opportunity to overcome the chaos, the busyness, and the financial frustrations of owning a dental practice. Imagine a dental practice where your appointment book is highly productive, doing the dentistry you enjoy, your team is self-motivated, and your profits keep climbing. That's what the 3D Business Mastermind is all about. In this exclusive mastermind, you'll join a league of ambitious dentists driven to elevate their practices. You'll gain access to proven strategies, personalized coaching, and a community that understands your journey. So if you're ready to supercharge your dental practice and enjoy the success you deserve, visit www.3d-dentists.com and take the first step towards a brighter future in dentistry by filling out the 3D Business Mastermind application. Now, let's get to this week's episode.
How about selling dental practices or land that you are next door to you?
It's a very, like, I don't understand your white people problems there. Okay.
You mean the fact that my grandma charged me $1.4 million for 0.6 acres is extreme?
Well, the fact that you gave her an offer above everybody else and then she told them to counter and made you counter is just would be...
Can't win them all.
Well, I get it. But so what happened, and even then, okay, so my dad paid for my dental school.
Right.
Okay. He gave me an allowance of like $800 a month or $900 a month to live. I couldn't live in that because I had high tastes and I liked gambling. So I came out with like 40, 50 grand in debt. And, and then, so then when Ravi went to school, I was like, I'll pay, you know, or I'll pay as much as I could at the time. I was starting to make good money then. Right. So I was happy to pay whenever, you know, whatever they asked or wanted. And it wasn't a means issue. It was more that my dad gave Ravi a choice. Okay. He said, Ravi, here are the choices. I'll pay for your dental school. Okay. Or I'll take the money I was going to use for your dental school. You take out loans and I will buy a motel or a hotel. And then when you get out, that'll be yours. And so my dad pretty much wasn't a question really. It was just do that. And that was the Wilson Hotel. So at that time, that money, that $150,000, $200,000 was so important because it allowed my dad to build a hotel.
Wow.
And that hotel, that one in Wilson, fed the one we built in Hope Mills, which fed the one we just finished in Fayetteville, which fed so much. So that it's about cash flow, right?
Sure.
So in theory, that $150,000, $200,000
is worth way more.
$4 or $5 million.
Wow.
Basically.
Wow.
So now the ability to pay that back is is insignificant, correct?
Sure.
And even then, you know, my dad said, okay, it's my duty, I'll pay for your loans. And my brother said, no, I'll pay for them. You just keep doing what you're doing. You know, so not because look, at the end of the day, and my dad always said this to me, like when I bought my house and all that stuff, he was like, you're just wasting cash flow. I'm never going to give you money. I'm never going to let you borrow anything because I know you're going to, in my mind, in his mind, I waste it.
Right.
Okay. He's like, that should all be put towards a business that grows. And, you know, it's a cultural difference, generational difference. But I think it's a good story for people to understand the value of money.
Well, and where you put the money sometimes,
Yeah, where you
it's,
put it.
And what's growth versus savings too, to some degree, right?
Which is absolutely. Talk about. And that's why I talk so much about you pay your retirement, your flexibility plan first, and then you live after that. So am I saying that correctly?
No, 100%. I think that was, for me, it didn't make sense at the time when he was like forcing, not forcing.
Because you're probably to some degree, I mean, at that age, I would imagine I would almost be like, come on, dad. I mean, you paid for
T-Bone. I didn't look at it that way. I didn't care that much, but I didn't really understand the power of what he meant by
that. Yeah, right? For sure.
You know, it really took me probably midway through residency to kind of make the realization that, wow, like that's what he means, invest in yourself. So save that, take that principal instead of throwing it away or spending it on education. Getting a loan is not a big issue. Yeah. And getting a loan at 5%
is nothing,
right? So compared to a business loan. So that's when it starts to make sense that wager, you know, for me to take that loan out, knowing that I'm going to specialize and knowing that I'm going to be fortunate to probably have a decent job and be able to pay it back on my own, meant so much more for him, my parents, and our family.
And I think the important thing to understand is a dollar you spend, my dad views it as $6, because every dollar you can borrow $5 against it. Okay, because like you're going through this now, right?
Yeah,
they want 20% down, right? So literally every dollar you have in hand is actually $5 from a bank. So that 100 grand or that $200,000 was $1 million,
wow,
right? So it's his ability to leverage up to $1 million is really what that boiled down to.
Is that just long-term versus short-term thinking? Is that what stops people from doing that?
I think people are willing. I think it's because people aren't willing to live with sacrifice. Okay. And people, and it is so much short-sighted thinking as well. But I think now more than ever, my generation, me included, we're not willing to live with sacrifice. We're not willing to go through the pain and the trouble that comes with it.
Yeah. And it depends on the level of risk that you want to take.
Sure.
You know, there are individuals who are super risk averse who will not take that leap. And then there are individuals who want to take on that risk. So that's also
it was a safe bet. Like, what's the worst thing that happened? My dad lost that money, let's say.
Sure.
He's going to be able to pay that back.
No, totally.
It's a secured loan in a way, right? I mean, against his career.
Right.
You know, and so that's it's just a good story.
So at this point, you've graduated surgery school. You know, did you think about, hey, well, gosh, I got a brother down here.
This is the second disappointment.
This is still a sore spot.
Okay, disappointment.
This is a sore spot for him and my parents.
Yeah. This was trouble for us.
You know, so through residency, so 4 years, right? So, you know, first 2 to 3 years, it was like coming back. You know, I'm going to finish, coming back. I was like,
everybody had it planned for you.
You're right. I was the luckiest person in the world. I mean, I really was. I had a brother who was doing great in the practice, who is a business mind that could help me.
I saved my office for him.
You know, and what time are we in right now?
This is 2010.
Yeah. So I had bought my new building. I didn't sell my old one because I bought it from an oral surgeon.
Well, and Dental Town's been a success at this point. Yeah. The meeting, all that stuff.
Yeah. We're doing great.
I mean, y'all are,
we're doing good.
Everything is like, come back to Raleigh. Yeah.
Right. And so for me, it was like a no brainer. I mean, everything played in my favor. I had a lot of my classmates were practicing in this area. So I'd be fortunate to have a decent referral base of people that I know and liked. I had a brother who's successful and doing well.
My best friend's an oral surgeon.
And then a good friend of ours is an oral surgeon. Mm. So like a no brainer person would say, you're an idiot. Just this is get done and get back.
And he would have done financially much better.
But when you go through the amount of training that I went through, I hate to say that there's a lot of private practice oral surgery that probably uses 25% of what you train.
Yeah, I get that. Right? I see that.
And so to enjoy all of that and then to give it all up was I just couldn't do it. I loved what I did. I mean, it was,
you love being the trauma part of it.
Well, I love the trauma. I love the major surgery. I like to be in the operating room. I like to be in the residency program where I had, you know, I had a bunch of smart people. you know, versus just lowly general dentists.
Well, it's not that.
No, but I would. But, no, but I think that's a great
office
point.
Setting, the office yeah. setting. Think about it. If you're by yourself in an office, there's not stimulation sometimes, right?
We preach that all the time.
I have 12 residents.
Not in our friend's office, Will Jones. There's stimulation there.
There's plenty of stuff there. But aside from that, the reality is, though, is that that's what we preach all the time. I mean, most general dentists and even specialists mm-hmm. tend to live on an island right. where they don't have that kind of pursuit of education, that challenge, that, hey, what do you think about this? What would you do here? And like, yeah. you know, that collaborative approach.
Yeah, you know, we have 3 surgeons, I have 12 residents. I have a bunch of part-time private oral surgeons who come and operate and teach at the hospital. And so we're constantly talking, constantly bouncing ideas off each other. And I have to stay on my toes. So I'm invigorated to stay on top of my game because I'm constantly motivated. You know, you're fortunate. You have a group of people that you get to talk to all the time.
Sure.
But
we have to create that, by the way.
Right. You created that. But, you know, most people in an office setting, like dentistry is an office-based practice, you don't necessarily have that. You don't have the camaraderie. So that's where between the scope of practice and the people that I got to work with, and to be honest, my chair and program director at the time was just a phenomenal individual.
Right.
And so he helped me kind of foster that interest when I said, I'm interested in staying, but I'd probably only want to stay in D.C. or come back to North Carolina. Those are my 2 options. I didn't really look hard at wanting to do this hospital-based program anywhere else.
Sure.
Because there's so many other factors in there.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, podcast family. T-Bone here, bringing you our newest live patient implant training, Full Arch Express. For dentists already placing implants and ready to level up and continue building their implant practice, this is the golden ticket. We're diving deep into Full Arch Implants, the hottest game changer in implant dentistry. In this program, we tackle both overdentures and all-on-X fixed hybrids, mastering techniques that are essential for modern, comprehensive dental care. It's about getting your hands on the tools and techniques that will replace the doubt and fear with confidence and predictability. Here's the kicker. There's live patient training right here in North Carolina. You're not just learning theories. You're in the operatory doing real work on real patient from start to finish, guided one-on-one by our expert 3D mentors. You'll learn the nuances of each approach, ensuring you can cater to a wide range of patients to maximize revenue. Speaking of revenue, with me, you know it's not just about the clinical skills. We're bringing business into this aspect too, teaching you how to integrate these advanced services profitably into your practice. So are you ready to rise up to the top in implant dentistry? Join us at the Full Arch Express. This isn't just another course, it's a career-defining leap. Head to www.3ddentist.com to enroll in our next session. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now, back to this week's episode.
So he was basically like, we'll take you here.
He's like, I'll make this work. I'll add you. At the time, it wasn't a position. He said, we'll make this work.
Wow. So it's two part. Okay. And I don't mean this in any way disrespectful because I'm unbelievably proud of my brother. Okay. One, he didn't come home, which bothered me. And then two, he went to work for the hospital. Like familiarly, like there is no one in my family that works for anyone. Right. Like not one
person. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. Like, not like one, the cultural
like I norms. Think I go through right. my entire family. Not one person works for anybody. Not one. From my uncles to my dad to my mom to my wow. aunt to
so what was your dad's nobody. Response?
Very similar to his. I mean,
but he's much quieter.
He's much more diplomatic. I mean, he understood where I was coming from, but at the same time, he was like, you're not going to, can't you just listen to him and say, follow your dreams, you can make anything happen? I was like, oh, I don't think it works that way. You know, and what I'm trying to do, I don't think it works that
like,
way.
Like, honestly, I probably don't accept that he works for the hospital more than he stayed in D.C. Like, I would, hey, I want to stay in D.C. It's kind of a fun city, right? But working for somebody, it doesn't make any sense.
It's funny because even now to this day, I have a dentistry mindset where I'm like, this is a small business, but I'm in my own department and I think it's a small business. And then it gets shut down so quickly because then you realize I work for a big corporation.
Right.
So like literally like trying to do a brochure. Like he like the problems he brings to me, I'm like, this is easy. Just put some money into it and make it happen.
He's like, no. It has to go through protocol.
Yeah, exactly.
It has to go to HR and marketing.
So
and
there's challenges like that, right? So everybody has their challenges. Mine are just very different.
But the positive is he has a stable job. Okay. He has benefits. He doesn't have to physically work as hard. You know, he's surrounded by people. And there's a level of progression that he can make, right? So he can start as an attending, which you did, I believe, correct? Then he moved to program chair.
Program director.
And then the next step would be chair, right? The chair of the department.
So how much interaction do you have with residents on a daily basis?
Every day.
But he's in charge of the residents. But this is what's so cool to me, because it's interesting, because in one dynamic, you're both so different. But on one, you look at you, T, and like, you created this entire culture and business around a desire to bring up people around you and push your profession. And then you have your other brother who on one hand took a different route, but he is completely doing the exact same thing and bringing up his profession.
It's very similar.
Yeah, but he doesn't call the shots. I mean, I call my shots.
He kind of is. Hootie's got a question. What up? Exactly. That's what I was getting at. Well, the question is both of them have this desire to apparently bring up those around them and teach in some capacity. I mean, you're doing that every day with residents. Right. You're doing that every day with me, Will, the rest of the attendees, everybody. What do you think instilled that drive in you or desire in you to do that?
Well, look, I talk so much about my dad. Okay, yeah. And so my answer is going to be around him, but I also have to give a lot of credit to my mom, who took a job making $17,000 a year as a teacher, drove for 2 years, drove 45 miles each way every single day to get a teaching certificate, to do something, quite frankly, she didn't have to do. I mean, there was a time where we needed the money. Okay, there was a time where that was there, but pretty quickly we didn't need the money. And on top of that, I look back and she taught autistic children. Okay,
so it's like
listen, to be politically correct, she taught mentally and physically handicapped children.
All right,
I got yelled at a lot. I need to be proper.
I appreciate
that. That was ingrained by my mother, who was very, very passionate about her job. Right,
who's some Agarwal needs to be there. Right,
thank goodness.
And I'm the diplomatic.
Yeah,
so clearly, they certainly, and I never thought about it that way until you kind of mentioned it, Hutan. Was that certainly was an influence? Okay, but I will say to me, my biggest influence on the teaching was, again, my dad. And it's not that he was a teacher, but he was. He always told, so when you're in the motel business and you start getting beyond one or two, or you reach a level where you're no longer like manage, you're not owner operator anymore. You're not like literally living in the motel like we used to do. You bring in the next family in.
Sure.
Okay. And they take over your spot. You replace yourself.
I was going to say, is that where that concept
That's exactly
kind
where it
of
came
started?
From. And then my dad, what he would always do is he would help that family, and he would tell them, I need you here for 3 years. No, he didn't say, I need you here forever. He'd be like, listen, I want you to be here 3 years. I need you to save this much money. And then when you're ready, I'll go help you pick out your own place so that you can have your own place.
What's interesting is that's also like the model of just true apprenticeship and how like
it's also the immigrant mentality.
Right?
Immigrant mentality.
But ultimately that's what built
our country. Was built on an immigrant mentality.
Right.
And then we lose it.
Right. Which is something that's killing us everywhere. Right.
Well, that's a different argument, But so I saw that constantly. I constantly saw him. And I constantly saw – the other thing I saw was we lived in a town of probably 8,000 people max.
Yeah, I think the county is maybe 40,000 people.
40,000 in the county, 8,000 in the city we lived in. And there were 8 motels in our city. We had a racetrack. We had a NASCAR racetrack there. 8 motels, 8 of which were owned by Indians. So we were all pretty competitive in the sense that there's only so much business to go around. But it wasn't competitive. We could call somebody and they could say, hey, we have sold this many rooms. We have this many left. This is the price we're charging. So that, that way everybody knew. So it was very collegial in a way. So I saw that. I saw people helping each other. I saw your competitors helping each other. That's what I saw growing up. That's how I saw that.
You didn't learn from a scarcity mindset.
No, I mean, certainly there was a competitiveness, certainly, right? And people always want to take care of themselves first to a certain degree, but it was a family atmosphere. Okay. And it was a help everybody atmosphere. And more so on my dad's side, what I saw was, hey, I want to get you started and then let's go somewhere. And if you can't afford it on your own and you've proved to me in 3 years, I'll own 51% of it. And then you can buy me out over after time. Right. So, and so that's kind of part of where that mindset of helping others, trying to lift them up and trying to get them to go somewhere else. And certainly maybe I'll benefit along the way. And it's kind of like I've always told you,
sure,
take what you can. And at some point, you know, step on your own feet, you know, yeah. And so that's been, you know,
it's a true community. I mean, it's hard to explain to a lot of people that Rockingham, the Indian population in Rockingham, vast majority, at least in the 80s and early 90s, there's probably 10 families, but it was a true
all
community.
All motel owners.
And almost all of them.
80-90% motel owners. Motel owners. Yeah.
And hotel. It was a true
there was community. No hotel.
It was honest. A true community.
Just to be clear.
You know, so I was fortunate because a lot of the families had, we were all the same age.
Not
T-Bone.
For me.
Yeah, T-Bone was kind of the old, like he was the old guy. That
there's one other, two one, other Indians.
Two other people.
Yeah.
You know, I had four or five people and we were all great friends. Our families were friends. You know, even though your business are right, literally right beside each other.
Wow.
Friday
wow.
nights, you're all getting together to eat dinner together. You know, eating together. You're forming partnerships, you form friends, you're doing business together. So it was such an interesting dynamic that I don't see replicated in a lot of the areas.
Well, you don't replicate that in a big city for sure.
Do y'all keep up with any of those people?
A little bit, certainly. Robbie's when it comes to personality-wise, he is way more social and way more friendly than I am. Like I'm a hobbit or hermit or whatever the word is. I like to keep to myself. Okay, I like to have the level of interaction that I want to have.
Is that more your mom or your dad?
That's probably more my mom. Yeah. I'm my mom. Socially, I'm my mom.
100%.
Okay? And socially, he's my dad.
I have my dad.
Yeah, he likes to cook. He likes to clean-ish. Okay? He likes to do those things, things that you'll never catch me doing, ever.
Yeah. So it's funny. We have a hybrid of both our parents. It's so sure. It's fascinating to me. I have my mom's kind of household sense.
Right.
You know, and I have my dad's social skill. He has my dad's brain and business sense and my mom's social side.
Interesting.
It's just
funny how it works out.
It's so funny how it works out.
Wow. So, okay. So now let's kind of jump a little bit.
So now where we're at is that we're finished residency. He's become program director is what you call it.
He's working
so
in DC.
He's charge of the residents. And at this point, it's kind of finally hit me, even though every time I go, sometimes I'll go meet Dr. Obeid, correct? I'll go meet him. I'm like, yeah, I think this is a horrible place. You should fire Ravi.
This guy is not who you need.
I'm like,
you should get rid of him. The family's out.
Can we start, like, at one point, can we start bringing, like, your brother around? Yeah. He's bad for the program.
I'm like, can you? And then
he's telling the residents that the guy teaching them is terrible.
I remember
you
one
should
time
choose another program.
My dad probably told Dr. Obeid, I think you should fire him. You should let my son go.
Wow.
And he just chuckled and just, you know, moved on.
So now as we move into, like, you practicing and, like, that dynamic, now let's start to get clinical a little bit. You know, now here you are, oral surgeon, you're pushing things and doing things in your setting. And then, you know, your brother's down south as a GP starting to push, you know.
He got over his fear of blood and
started to push surgery and then become somewhat of one of the advocates for GPs doing surgery. How does that conversation go when T-Bone calls you?
This was a lot of entertaining car rides.
Yeah, or Mona, my wife, would always be like you got to call him and make up with your brother. I'm like, what do you mean make up? We're just having a conversation. No, you guys were arguing.
We're arguing.
By the way, your wife can tell. I'm pretty sure she knows when someone's arguing and when they're not.
Or we're on a family trip. We're in the minivan. His family, me, my parents, and him and I are in the front seat. And we start getting to a dentistry talk. You can tell everybody else is just getting upset and pissed off. And then we start, it's escalating, right? The voices are rising, we're yelling, and we're both very passionate. And it's very much the initial arguments where, you know, you arrogant oral surgeons, you're always doing shit wrong. And I'm like,
You're not using guides, you're putting the implants in the wrong spots.
You know, the implants are coming out way in the wrong direction. I'm like, well, you guys don't know what you're doing. You're not reading anything. You don't know any science.
You don't think about the bone, you think about the soft tissue, you're just putting in a screw.
Right. And then my mom's like, please, you guys are arguing, please stop. Like, and she's like, apologize to each other. And we just stopped talking to each other for like a good 10 minutes, you know, in the car ride. And then dentistry probably wouldn't talk that much more over the weekend.
So, okay, besides that, though, how did that conversation go? Like, I seriously am curious, like, the perspective of how did y'all work through that then? Because on one hand, your brother's right in that, like, GPs for life. As that,
and then as the whole room laughs at me right now,
GPs should be starting to place some implants. But yeah, but on some app, you've gone 4 years to do this training and to do all this stuff.
What's your, in other words, what's your take on what we're doing?
So my personal,
there's a balance,
opinion,
right? It's somewhere in the middle. It's, let me be clear.
I'm not one that says that you shouldn't do something, right? I'm the one that says if you do something, you need to know how to manage.
Totally agree.
And so that was a hard part because I spent a lot. I'm a science guy. My brain works on a science level.
He's a boring academic.
Right. AKA literature.
Right. Right.
Or excited.
So, not like ridiculous way off the deep end of literature, but you're kind of thinking about it from that perspective. And the conversations we have were very much not that. So it was hard for me to tell, kind of explain, say.
Because you would back things up with.
Right.
Something, and then he would be like, well it just works.
Yeah, it just works. Well, I don't have a problem. I've never
last
had a fail.
Last time I checked, right. Yeah. I'm placing them.
I've not had an implant fail. I'm like, okay.
Well, no, I've never said that. I don't have anything fail.
That's kind of like what the thought process is. It's like, right. Clinically, this is working as acceptable. Right? Clinically acceptable.
I can't help it. You're seeing bad dentists do this stuff, and that's what you get to see.
This is also a challenge, right, that you get as a specialist.
Certainly as a hospital-based specialist.
As a hospital-based specialist, you're kind of a dumping ground. Anything in dentistry,
even from surgery, the oral surgeons,
even for, or sometimes oral surgeons, everybody, right? Everybody just dumps, and you kind of look and you scratch your head and say,
"What were they thinking?"
You kind of want to pick up the phone and say, "What is going on here? What led you?
What were you not thinking?"
Right. So that was, but it was never about don't do this or not do this. It was more like I think probably more he was leaning on me to see what we're doing, and I'm leaning on him to see how do I communicate better, what's happening in the community. So that I'm better prepared to train, to deal. You know, a lot of my practice is referral based as well.
Sure.
So I'm kind of trying to figure out how to negotiate those things.
I think the big disconnect between general dentists and specialists is the technology and how much the technology undoes so much of the hand skill. Technology doesn't change the science. It doesn't change a lot of that stuff. But it does change the surgery.
It's the great equalizer.
It is. You know, you copied that from me.
I'm pretty sure I took that.
You took that from me.
Dang it. Walked into that one.
So,
well, here's my question then. So, because that was kind of where I was going was, do you find, Harvey, that almost some of the conversations you would have would, because I'm assuming that from a residency mindset, it's very traditional thinking in the way that you practice and do it. And then here he comes out trying to be super progressive, and then like there's this dichotomy of like, well, gosh, that does sound unique, but that's different. And
I don't know if I personally never felt that way, because I think our residency program was always also on the cutting edge.
You okay,
know? Maybe not on like, you know, we knew about.
By the way, it was on the cutting edge, not because of other oral surgeons, but because you had a prosthodontist.
I have a prosthodontist
that was very digitally oriented.
Very digitally, okay. Very pushing the border, pushing the frontier on what we do. And so we didn't actually have that much of a dichotomy in what he's thinking and doing and what we're doing. It's just, you know, as a surgeon and in a residency program, I'm maybe a few years behind on, you know, I got a digital scanner, 3 years ago now. I've been doing
a few years, you know, yeah. When I got one.
When
in
you got one, right? But at the same time, we don't do a restorative work either.
Right.
So you didn't see the value until the paradigm starts changing, and then we try to stay on the front edge of it.
Yeah. So in Ravi's defense, though, okay. So what I've seen, and I would hope that I played some role in that, is that his residency is doing digital impressions. His residency is doing digital planning. They're teaching the residents how to do 3D planning. They're teaching the residents how to do 3D modeling for orthognathic surgeries. They're teaching printing. They're teaching all of these things to the surgeons, because what they're starting to see is that it's going to become part of practice moving forward.
Right.
And so they're one of the few residencies, I believe, maybe not as much anymore.
Yeah, we like to think so. I have no way of knowing.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right. That when you look at what you're doing, to me, you almost want to call it honorable, but how do you,
How do I don't, you, that's not what I think of it
well,
as.
But my point is like when you look at you and what you're doing, and I know what your reimbursements are and some of that stuff, what is the drive to stay in a hospital setting when you know there's oral surgeons out there in private practice?
Quadrupling what you're doing. No, it really
just,
economically.
You wouldn't call that honorable?
I would call that silly, but
I like to think of it as honorable.
Well, I think the
give you the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, for me, it's there's a simple fact. It's my scope of practice is I get to practice the full scope of what I'm
doing. You couldn't do what you do now in private practice.
I could
not
do what I do.
Because you'd be doing it for free.
You'd be doing it for free, or you're going to be the mindset is if you're a small business owner, these things lose money.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're doing it for free.
So you're doing it for free. So there are a lot of people who do.
Is that a problem? Like long term, just getting outside of what we're talking about. Do you think that's an issue? Like, is that going to become like to bite us?
This is a tough. It's such an interesting thing because it's a dilemma in the field. You know, so let me answer the question this way. For example, in Europe, hospital based OMS is a separate track than office based OMS.
The residency programs.
Oh, so interesting. So to do hospital work, your maxillofacial surgery. And to do hospital work, I mean, to do office kind of dental.
You're an exodontist, basically.
Exodontia.
Well, arguably, why are you doing a four-year residency surgery to take out wisdom teeth and put in implants?
Right. So that.
Because a general dentist can do it in a weekend.
Exactly. Proof of concept.
That's not even a weekend. That's just YouTube.
It's quite fine. I don't have a good answer. It's hard to know because I think, personally, I think practice is a pendulum. So things start to shift one way, and then something happens in politically, something happens in healthcare, and then things will start to shift back.
That's a good point.
So I think it's just constantly, we're just seeing this shift. Like, you know, the dentistry in the 90s was like the heyday, right? Everybody's doing quite well, at least in surgery especially.
I think we're in the heyday now, but
I think oral surgery, you're starting to see this shift where everybody's corporate is taking over dentistry. You're seeing changes in practice, you're seeing people who are not, reimbursements are lower. So you're seeing people have to do more.
More are taking insurance.
More
taking
insurance.
I moved here in 99, 2000, 2001, when I started my practice in 2001, I couldn't find it other than a few. Like, you had the oral surgeons that you knew took insurance. So you had the insurance oral surgeons, and then you had the non-insurance.
Now,
oral surgeons.
I'm assuming they all take it.
Now, for the most part, they all take it. Yeah. So you're seeing the shifts. Things that affected us 10 years ago are affecting them now. It affects them 8 to 10 years. Specialists get affected 8 to 10 years later. Orthodontists are seeing that on the direct-to-consumer side. Okay, we're not seeing direct-to-consumer exodontia, okay, but we're seeing direct-to-consumer orthodontics.
So let's talk about that, because obviously I'm assuming that when you go to these oral surgeon meetings and you're having conversations,
they're very stuffy.
I'm sure they are.
Because I actually spoke at one. But
you got to figure there's got to be this moment where, as an oral surgeon, you're looking at this and saying, okay, wait a second. GPs, periodontists, endodontists—they're taking a giant sector of what we were really trained to do. What is the move for oral surgery as a whole? Not just like compete against that, but just to
prepare,
adjust.
I'll be honest. I don't know if that our national association is—they're targeting that, but at the same time, it's not that well talked about enough to say there's a game plan. I think
it's interesting.
You know, I think the oral surgery side of things, we're thinking probably full arch, you know, those larger cases, especially the need for anesthesia, that's still going to kind of be in the wheelhouse.
We're doing more and more of those now.
You're doing more and more of now, but you have a sick patient. You have, you know, I think you are, but I think the vast majority of practitioners are not.
I don't know, though.
To answer the question, vast majority are not.
No, totally.
But a bigger and bigger number are doing
it. We talked about this a little bit off air. You know, I have a good buddy who's an oral surgeon of mine. He actually is my anesthesiologist, as I call him, because whenever I'm doing full arch dentistry, I bring him in to do, because I can't do propofol. So he comes in and does that.
Sure.
But what we joke
about.
And
based on the IV sedation class you took, you can't do IV
sedation. Based off the fact that I took an IV sedation class that wasn't approved, I currently can't IV sedate people.
False advertising said it was approved.
Well, I can't say anything right now because I'm in a settlement.
I just wanted to say that.
But what we discuss is, it's interesting. Here I am, a GP, a couple years out of school, doing way more full arch dentistry than a oral surgery MD who's been 10 years out of school because so much of that market is moving from to a direct-to-consumer market.
Well, I would ask the question then, is that individual actually trained and thoughtful about implant dentistry?
You're talking about the oral surgeon?
Yeah.
Because I think, personally, there's just because you're an oral surgeon doesn't qualify you to do implants.
To put in a bunch of implants.
Because you go to a training program. There's a training program that places 10 to 15 implants.
Oh, if you're an oral surgeon that's been out 20 years, you might not have placed many at all.
Yeah. Or the way you did them was blades or not.
I think the thing that Robbie's missing, and most oral surgeons are missing, is those cases aren't direct to consumer. Those cases come from the GP.
Exactly. Right.
And the GP is
starting we're a referral to, business.
We're right. controlling where things are going.
But I would even argue those patients aren't walking in our door.
Yeah.
We're getting those cases because we're marketing. And so this is
and we're marketing the fact that we're one place to get it done.
Right. And that to me is a challenge because I don't think traditional oral surgeries is built off a total referral model.
100%.
And it is changing. And it has to because most GPs that are marketing to it, they're marketing it from a we do it all perspective. Mm-hmm. You, myself, Will, etc. Whereas no GP is spending the money to market to bring them in and say, oh yeah, well, I can do the restorative portion. Let me send you to the oral surgery.
Portion. This is a fear for me is that I'm training individuals who are going to go out and then just work at a GP office. You know, they're going to work at 5 GP offices. One day a week, they're at a GP office.
Why is that a negative?
Because you train to do all these things that you can't practice if you're just going to be
an implant and wisdom tooth doctor.
Right.
That's the only thing. By the way, that's what most oral surgeons are now. Okay. By most oral surgeons in private practice are take out teeth, take out wisdom teeth, place implants.
Then what's the point of going to a 4-year residency?
I mean, the profession's gonna have to answer that question.
Yeah, I don't know if it's gonna change, when it's gonna change, or if that pendulum's gonna swing back.
And then maybe go to the European model.
It may, or what's gonna happen is that
we're gonna screw things up so badly.
No, the practice dynamics will change where you're gonna see a shift back of oral surgeons having to do more what they train to do to be successful.
Look, right? At the end of the day, I think. One, it's a shame that your reimbursements are what they are for some of the stuff that you have to do, because it is unbelievably challenging and cool some of the stuff that you're able to do that we can't do, especially as we
and they're subsidized by the hospital, basically.
Right, and then that's unfortunate because you have this corporate entity making all this money and pulling all this stuff in, and here you are doing the work and you're getting paid some stupid reimbursement.
Yeah, but they spend the money to build the place. To attract the patients.
But still, at some point, the problem is it's not sustainable. Like long term, something's going to have to happen, or you're going to have no one willing to do the surgeries.
Well, I'll make an argument, and I can't speak for everybody, but it's not like you struggle in academia to have a good life or to do what you want to do, right? So if you chose the profession to say, I want to make buku money, then you're not going to be in my setting. But if you want, I'm not going to say that I'm struggling either, by no means. You live a comfortable. I live in D.C. Right. It's one of the most expensive cities in the country. It's not like, you know,
he makes.
You can afford to do all the things you want.
Good for you.
Am I going to own a private plane? No. Am I going to own?
I was shocked when he got paid in a hospital in the academic setting.
Right. So, but we work hard for it. So there's just a different dynamic and headaches.
Well, it's probably more rewarding in some levels too.
100%. You know, it's reward. You know, I love put it this way.
This is where we get the parents are different. This is the business in mind and the one, you know, the difference.
You know, he just doesn't see, he knows what we do, but just like he gets to practice a full scope of general dentistry, I get to practice a full scope.
My answer is very simple. Come to private practice, work 2 days a week, you'll make the same money, and then go do your free stuff that you want to do the other 2 days
a
week.
But you know what? I bet on some level, I think what's cool about this is probably just like your ego is driven in some way. Part of it for probably Ravi is that the fact that like he does some stuff that no one else can do.
Or puts him in a position to do.
And so for him to be able to sit there and say, you know, like that on some point I would get that. Like that would drive me.
Maybe you're a millennial. That's
like I'm like, gosh, this is cool.
You know,
he's not like, no offense, oldie, but he's 8 years younger than you.
So. Right, so, but he's 83. He's the first year millennial.
Exactly.
Correct?
I don't categorize myself.
I'm a zennial.
Dude, okay? We would love to take you on as a millennial.
Listen, this is the argument that we have every day. This is a conversation that every person in training has. What do I do? How do I make my career? I just had this conversation with my group last week. They said, can you talk to me about kind of what career path can we have? And I said, the way I started the conversation is something that T-Bone's actually pushed onto me. He said, you're in America. You can do what you want. You just have to know how to do it and where to do it.
And be willing to work.
And be willing to make it happen. So someone's like, well, I want to do this and this. I said, you can. You're not going to do this in D.C. because that's not the market for
you. You have to sacrifice something to get
there. You're going to have to sacrifice something.
You have to move to Wisconsin.
Right. Or go to North Dakota. Like I was talking to somebody earlier, and you can do everything you want to do. You're not going to have the barriers. So that was the interesting part of it, is just trying to empower them to say, don't fall in the trap of, you know, corporate's going to come and show you a big number to work for them. But just remember that practice can be very monotonous. I mean, I have a lot of colleagues that are in corporate and they're bored.
Yeah.
Because all they do is exodontia. They drive around the state and just do exodontia. And it's not very stimulating.
That's their own choice. No,
100%. They made their choice. But a lot of them.
It's not right or wrong.
It's not right or wrong. It's just say that that's one way of doing it. I just hate to see 4 years of my time and education and the hard work that, you know, 90, 100 hours a week.
Yeah, I can go to the Dominican for a week and learn how to do
it. That's right. How easy is it? No. Okay. Gosh, that is downplaying what they're doing.
I'm just
he wants to push every button to see if he can get some emotion.
He's trying.
I'm just needling.
Well, here's where I think a fun place to kind of wrap up. And
no,
move
I don't want to wrap up. I want to talk about his sleep stuff.
That's why. Did you hear what I said, Remy? As we move forward and going and wrapping up, I literally said that.
But he has to butt in.
What I want to do is talk about where sleep comes
into this. It's the T-Bone Speaks podcast.
By the way, I just want to drop in. If y'all haven't checked out the Millennial Dentist podcast, it is a great podcast. Check it out on iTunes, millennialdentist.com, drsullysullivan.com. Check it out.
You know when I knew I loved Sully? Okay. You know when I knew I loved
him? I know exactly what you're going to say.
I invited him.
Which is funny because I didn't think anything of it.
I invited him to attend a mastermind that I was doing. Okay.
And one of your courses.
So we had a course that we did at the Sheraton Hotel at RTP.
Okay.
We had like 80 or 90 people there. And I invited Sully to come. Aaron was teaching that, and I would hold a mastermind on the side. So I invited Sully to attend this mastermind with a few other people. And he just shows up and he puts up a sign marketing his stuff in my meeting. This is
totally you.
Right, it's totally
I had like one of those pop-up posters, you know, where you pull it, whoop, and then here it is.
So I was like, you're right. I'm like, God, that's something I would do.
And I'm like, hey, where can I put this thing? Is this good?
And I said, yeah, put it outside.
Out the front door.
Please. Yeah, please over there.
So let's kind of move towards probably something that fits into what we're doing, some of what our audience is doing, and that is the role of, okay, so traditionally I thought of oral surgeons as competitors to us in the sleep world, because many of them were in network with insurance because they have the degree and other things they were doing, and many of them actually were making devices, oral appliances,
sure.
Okay. So I've always had a very adversarial thought process to oral surgeons and sleep apnea therapy, until I read your blog. Not that you told me about it, but until I read your
blog. What's your blog?
Yeah, the hospital put out a blog about just almost like a patient blog about corrected jaw surgery and its relation to sleep.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I saw it on Facebook.
We'll link that.
Yeah, so I saw it on Facebook, and I'm like, why didn't you tell me about this? So I'll let you take it from here, Sully.
So tell us a little bit about how you kind of got into sleep. Was it, you know, obviously T-Bone started doing a lot of this. Did that drive any factor in it? Were you doing this early in residency? Talk about that.
In residency, when I was in residency, one of the surgeons who was working with us was interested in obstructive sleep apnea. And he actually was doing a joint clinic, him as an oral maxillofacial and an ENT, and they would see patients together to treatment plan, to make decisions about, you know, the way our practice has been built is we would do hard tissue work and the ENT would do the soft tissue work. So a UPPP, you know, tongue-based reduction,
sure,
or hyoid suspension, things like that. And we would concentrate on bringing mandibles forward, bringing chins forward. And so I had a lot of training on that. And we actually were doing devices at the time as well to supplement that sleep practice. But it was a natural progression because one of my big passions has been corrective jaw surgery, so correcting malocclusions.
Or traditional orthognathics.
Or traditional orthognathics. And we know that those same procedures can have effect on the airway. It's just natural anatomy that if I bring the mandible forward, all the musculature around the airway comes forward, and that could help change the shape of someone's airway and help eliminate obstruction. So for me, that kind of, once I started working, that kind of just came a bit of the practice that I could grow into, just because our center is already so strong at orthodontic surgery.
And a side note is, I'm always going to come to the business lesson in it, right? The business lesson is it's another way to differentiate, right?
Totally.
So even in the setting, as oral surgeons, they're fighting with other oral surgeons. Even in a hospital setting, he's fighting with other oral surgeons, right? So the more things you can do that kind of differentiate you from others, you know, that's part of the focus on doing this is, yes, he has a passion for it, all that stuff, but it's fundamentally, this is one way to make me stand out.
This is a segmentation of jaw surgery that I can kind of grow in and market and build upon. Because for example, my partner is not doing those things. My boss is not. He was interested in corrective jaw surgery, but he said, you concentrate on the sleep then if that's what you're interested in. I said, no, 100%.
So my guess is, and T-Bone, tell me what you think on this, that traditionally the majority of us as GPs, or even when you get into the orthodontic realm, it's always the goal of like, how can I avoid surgery? How can I avoid surgery?
I don't know if that's our goal or we're thinking for the patients.
That's my point though. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, I think we're driving that narrative. Mm-hmm. And when I start talking to him, I'm like, gosh, are we doing a disservice to some of these younger patients?
Yeah. So we don't know our products. That. Right. At the end of the day, no oral surgeon has ever, other than my brother, has ever come to me and talked to me about, hey, have you considered this as an option for some of your children or some of your adolescents or your teenagers? No one.
You're right.
None of the orthodontists have come to me and talked about that. Right. So if
both of our defense, we don't know what we don't know.
Well, maybe they don't know what they don't know. I mean,
oral surgeons?
Or many of them, absolutely.
Sure,
orthodontists. I'm just saying they're not doing these surgeries in private practice because they become exodontists, correct? And implantologists. So these, again, more academically based procedures. Now, there are certainly private practitioners that have built a practice around this, okay? Typically, they're in groups where maybe several of the partners kind of fund everything in a way, and one person does the passion, right? So I just think what... I don't take the blame on this because I'm unwilling to take blame on anything. But if somebody came to me and presented a justifiable point of view, then 100% I'm going to educate my patients and tell them it's worth it.
So talk about that then from your point of view.
So my point of view is that obviously obstructive sleep apnea is a disease. It's a problem. And it's just growing. You've seen more and more of this country is getting diagnosed more. And I think the role of, in my opinion, the role of dentistry is that you're going to screen, you're going to see, you're going to help manage, especially non-surgically, right? So 100%, if I got diagnosed with sleep apnea, I'm not thinking I need to fix it surgically. I'm going to see what are my options.
And obviously, you believe he doesn't actually have sleep apnea?
Really?
No, you tested him. You.
When was the last time you were tested?
Never.
Oh, that's interesting.
No witnessed apnea.
Oh, bull crap. We have an extra teeth and sleep test running around?
Oh, boy. After having a beer, I'm going to go home and sleep on one of these and definitely have sleep apnea.
That's exactly right.
I'm sorry to
interrupt. No, it's okay. So it's interesting that I had this conversation with him probably 6, 7, 8 months ago. I said, are you discussing in your classes about what patients may benefit from surgery? Or what are you talking about surgical options or sending them? And he said, well, I may send them to an ENT. And that's when I was like, all right, so I'm failing now to figure out at some point I'm going to have to work on this to have better outreach to explain to them what an oral surgeon can do.
Well, because here you are and your brother teaches courses or at least influences people who teach courses. That
Yeah, I teach courses too.
Yeah, you were there 15 minutes today. We appreciate that.
45.
Thank you.
Get it right, Sonny. Come on. the thing that for me, the ones that jump out. Is in everybody who practices dentistry should figure out is which patients have a skeletal deformity, right? Because if they have a skeletal deformity, there's an anatomic reason that they may have obstructive sleep apnea.
Gotcha.
Outside of being too thick, being too heavy, having a big neck. But those who are class 2, those who have a really small chin, those who may have, say, mid-face retrusion or, you know, the maxilla is a class 3. They can't breathe through their nose because their maxilla is hypoplastic. So these are the patients that jump out immediately to say, if you suspect sleep apnea, there's actually probably a functional problem with their occlusion, but there's also that benefit to correcting it that would help the airway.
And we as the general dentist probably need to be then potentially relaying that to the orthodontist because we don't have sets.
I think at the end of the day, I think you can see it visually. These are typically obvious.
Occlusion-wise, if it's skeletally, sometimes you can't.
One of the fears I have is that is the amount of orthodontics being done in general dentistry now. If you're not thinking,
don't blame us. Blame Smile Direct Club. Well, the amount of orthodontics being done directly in CVS.
Yeah, but even in general dentist, he makes a good point because the problem is, we have to be careful when we start to get from adult aesthetic orthodontics doing adult.
That's why I believe in 20 aligner or less orthodontics.
16-year-olds and 17-year-olds that are skeletal classifications. Right.
They may have a skeletal deformity that you're not picking up on if you're not thought. To think like an orthodontist or think like a surgeon who does jaw surgery, that there's a lot of benefit to surgery, both functionally, but say even cosmetically, facial harmony, but also that 16-year-old who's in your office that has a class 2 that you just camouflage, think about what's going to happen 20 years from now.
Yep.
They're going to gain 30, 40 pounds, and next thing you know, they have obstructive sleep apnea, and it's probably something that could have been, still can be corrected, but you could have saved... That could have been done on the front end.
So certainly I'll buy into your argument for adolescence. I buy into your argument overall, okay? But I would push hard with parents and adolescents. Okay, I'll push hard, okay? I agree in that.
But the hard part is part of it too, though, is we have to push hard with the orthodontists. Because what we're not...
I think you push hard to oral surgeons that do the surgery, and then they work with the orthodontist.
I get that, but a lot of times the first people they're going to is orthodontists. And if you don't understand your orthodontist,
come to us first, and then we feed the orthodontist.
So you're saying we should feed the oral surgeons first?
In those specific cases, yes.
Mm. And I'll make an argument as well.
Or you should preset the patient that when you go to the orthodontist, insist on who is the oral surgeon or who is the surgical person to see if you would benefit.
But I also make an argument. There's another group that I see a lot of. So a lot of my referrals are not necessarily orthodontists. They're actually from sleep docs and ENTs.
Oh.
So a lot of my practice, and then I'm triaging that patient now, having a preliminary conversation about, all right, you do have a skeletal deformity. You do have some orthodontic issues that ideally, in the ideal world, I should send you to an orthodontist, do ortho, because that will change the surgery. That will benefit the surgery.
Well, almost always it's combination, correct?
No. There's a lot. There are patients who are just by max retronathic. They have a good occlusion. There's really no, it may not necessarily need orthodontics, and they can have surgery.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But I always tell them that orthodontics still may be needed because surgery may not keep your occlusion perfect either. There's always that millimeter chance of things not fitting.
So again, with adolescents, I 100% agree that we need to be, here's what I believe, and this is going to be a plug, okay? For the part 2 of sleep apnea training that I think we need as 3D dentists to lead the charge on is we're doing a good job of helping our people work with adults, okay? Picking the field goal cases, getting the right cases, getting the green lights, light yellow light cases, and getting there. But I think what is also happening, I think we need to start educating on the adolescents, okay, to do some type of habit correction at age 6, 7, 8, 9 through removable devices, to then even at 10, 11, 12, 13, to start looking at skeletal issues and start kind of farming our patients to the right place or the right people. Like I'd send somebody to DC to see him and I'd tell a patient, this is where you need to go, right? So we need to start doing that. I think certainly, we need to provide that education. So I keep inviting you down the low price of nothing to come.
I can't believe you're turning that down.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll buy you a ticket.
He'll put you up with your parents. What could go wrong?
It's easy. I won't put you up here. I'll put you up with my parents, but your parents too.
my challenge is though, is that we as a general dentist though have to also understand where our orthodontists come from and sometimes the philosophy in which they practice and be willing to challenge them a little bit and to think differently and to be open to surgery.
I think to bring in
this collaborative approach.
The next level of training, correct?
I am chief of wanting to be a super GP. Mm-hmm. I think the definition of super
GP is having understanding of all the choices that are out there.
But I'm also the chief now of wanting to have awesome relationships with specialists that at some point I can't do it.
Nor should you do it.
Exactly. And at some point there has to be that level of like, this is where you punt. And this is where you bring in your team because they get better care from that. And so that all goes back to education and trying to challenge our own selves, because if we can't challenge the orthodontists, then the problem is we send them there and then they're thinking, oh, we can, they all start, all of a sudden start preaching this non-surgical narrative.
Or they do mini implants.
You're a parent, you're going to be pro non-surgical.
Right.
And even if it's not going to benefit your 100%.
Child. 100%. Yeah, I mean, you know, the number of patients that probably I'm not seeing because the orthodontist knows there's a skeletal problem, kind of brought it up to the family. But, and the
their bias is projecting another
way. And we just accept it. Like, oh, we told them the options. Well,
hey, right.
And not yeah. to, and, you know, I hate knocking orthodontics, but it's become, you know, like we mentioned earlier, their practices are changing, right? Smile Direct, Invisalign, general dentistry taking on simple orthodontic cases. So they don't want to lose a case, right? So if they say Andy needs surgery, that patient's going to leave, walk out the door and go to the orthodontist right down to the door. Who's like, no, you don't need surgery. We can fix this. We can camouflage this case.
But, and this is where I would argue with, not argue, but I would just, and to me, until we had this conversation tonight, I am looking for a non-surgical approach. So to me, this discussion has to be led by your profession. It has to be led by more people like you.
Well, I would argue that we could lead it as educated dentists.
We can now that we're in that position. But my point is that it. I would like to see it come more from your profession.
It's all around.
They're the experts.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's all around, right? So say, you know, a surgical candidate really should be somebody who's relatively close to skeletal maturity. So we're looking 14, 15, 16. It's probably on the younger side sometimes. But pediatric ENTs are taking tonsils and adenoids out on any 5 or 6 year old that has suspicion of sleep apnea. That patient probably needs to also be seen by pediatric dentistry, orthodontics, things like that to monitor growth because there could be a skeletal.
They need habit correctors.
You know, they may need all those things. And, you know, that patient needs to be lifelong watched. And all these people need education so that to know that, hey, jaw surgery may be in your future and that's something that's coming down the road. Or tonsil and adenoids take care of it and habit correction takes care of it and done.
Can I switch the conversation to adults? Well, what adults would benefit from this, from what you're talking about with corrective jaw surgery?
A lot. I mean,
with T-bone?
Theoretically.
Other than the fact that he's a wimp?
Other than the fact that he's a wimp and will be the worst surgical patient ever. theoretically.
What makes you think that?
Theoretically, right. So this is the challenge on our end is that you don't look at T-bone and say he has a dental facial deformity.
Right. There's no skeletal issue.
You know, you can make an argument maybe there's some mild mid-face retrusion, but this is, again, it's just subjective.
I noticed a little mild mid-face retrusion.
Whatever the hell that means.
So, yeah. So, you don't think of it
right,
much because his occlusion is fine.
Exactly.
So theoretically, if he has a severe sleep apnea or which even moderate, right, that can maximal mandibular advancement benefit him? Yes. The hard part is trying to figure out how much benefit. Because literature, so this is where the science comes out to me, this is what a conversation I have with an adult, is maximal mandibular advancement can benefit. It may take somebody who's, the goal would be that you get 50% reduction in RDI, whichever one you follow. That is deemed a success in scientific literature. So the success rates, what we praise, sometimes they're a little skewed because it may just be a 50% reduction,
right?
Which is still life-saving.
The biggest thing, just go from a 90 to a 45.
Right. Well, that 90 to 45, the big thing for us is that it may make CPAP tolerable.
Sure.
Or appliance therapy more effective.
More effective, right. So it may take that CPAP from plus 15 now to plus 5, and now you don't have an air blower in your face all night long. Yeah, so that's more tolerable. So these are the conversations that are hard because you don't know. When I see somebody who just has a retinopathic mandible and a small chin, you know there's a skeletal deformity, and so you know that there's going to be a lot of benefit.
How much surgery is it for an adult to get this done?
It's a big surgery. It's not major surgery, but it does an eruption in life because the recovery from surgery can be anywhere from 2, 4, 6 weeks.
They can't go to work?
Most patients, so my average patient who doesn't have a very intense job will be at home for 2 weeks at minimum. Yeah. I would probably say the adult, you know, an older adult may be a month, you know, so, but everybody's recovery is a little bit different.
Mine have trouble skipping yoga on Fridays,
you know, so, but there's risk to it. You know, the biggest one that I think most people are always concerned about, especially in dentistry, is the concept of numbness, that, you know, they're going to have numbness of their lips.
Yeah. Well, concept, that was the first question I asked him. I said, okay, how many on these, when you're doing these bilateral sagittal splits, how many are being numb?
Right. Know? So, you know,
because that's terrifying to us.
Right. In the maxilla, the vast majority get almost 95, 96% recovery. During a sagittal split in an adult, you're going to see some level of change in sensation.
Dysesthesia, basically.
Not dysesthesia. Okay, no. They're going to have hyposthesia of some sort or paresthesia.
Like a tingling of the lip or something like that. Right.
Dysesthesia means it's painful. Okay. And that's rare.
Okay.
You know, have I had a patient have dysesthesia? Yes. I always warn because that's, you see that more commonly as the older you get, the chance of having dysesthesia is higher.
Gosh.
So that's always a scary one, right? So dysesthesia is the one that you always kind of, I have to frame that for patients that there's a chance of having some numbness, but sensory. And I'll tell you that in my practice, I would say the 9 out of 10 patients at 1 year later will tell you that it doesn't bother them. They sure. Some don't even know it's there. They may still have a little bit. And a lot of them would say they'll do surgery again.
Does traditional orthognathic surgery address this?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So they take into account expansion and... Yes. And
you know, if you're going to correct someone's occlusion, the vast majority of the time, the occlusion is going to dictate a lot of what you're going to... For someone who's a narrow maxilla, you can't set a class one bite without expanding the maxilla. The change in paradigm probably is more that in the 80s and 90s, it seemed to be that setbacks, mandibular setbacks were much more common. Yeah,
4 on the floor.
You know, versus now we're very much a pro moving mandibles, maxillas forward and trying to minimize setback. Now, I'm not saying that we don't set mandibles back. It's more just that, you know, versus, you know, they used to set back mandibles 8-10 millimeters, and now we may actually move the maxilla forward 5 or 6 versus 2.
I gotcha.
To minimize the setback.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So basically, the gist of it is orthognathic surgery, jaw corrective surgery, is an option that we should be discussing with select sleep apnea patients that are severe or have obvious skeletal deformities, because it may be a true correction of the problem versus an appliance, which is a management, or a CPAP, which is a management.
Especially if there's a skeletal deformity.
Yeah.
So even patients who don't or have a good occlusion, maximal mandibular advancement is still a potential alternative or solution for them.
Right. So you'll be happy to start being part of the level 2 class and part 2?
I'd love to. I mean, I think this is such an interesting...
And I can pay you nothing?
Well, we may have to work on that one a little bit. Yeah, remember, I'm in a hospital. Okay. You know,
Mom will send you home with food.
Yeah, I'm guaranteed to take food back home. Like,
I'll let you take care of my dog and kids.
Selfishly, okay? I think there's a ton of value in that. I mean, we need... The problem is we need more people like yourself speaking.
We just need to learn more.
Exactly. And because it all comes back to you don't know what you don't know. 100%. You do the best you can with what you got. And sometimes, you know, you make sacrifices because you don't know any different. And this is one of those times. I already can think of patients who I'm like, gosh, maybe we should have been more proactive in pushing surgery. When my initial instinct prior to our discussion earlier this evening was avoid surgery at all costs. Like, that's the worst thing you want to do is surgery.
Right. And you remember, you have to keep in mind that also that just at least have the conversation with the patient. I mean, someone who's mild, who doesn't have much a device.
It's all risk benefits.
You know, but if you have a severe sleep apnea patient, that person needs to have that treated because this is a deadly disease ultimately.
What do you know about like tongue stimulators or some of those things? Are you familiar with a lot of
I am, yeah.
So do you do any of that work?
I personally don't, but one of the ENT surgeons I work with closely is doing a lot of those procedures. You know, the hypoglossal nerve stimulator is a device that almost like, the best way I would describe it is it's like a pacemaker that gets put in your chest. There's leads that go to the hypoglossal nerve, which at nighttime you cut it on. And so if it senses that your chest is not moving, it'll send a little signal to your hypoglossal nerve to stick your tongue out. You don't notice, you won't know it. It doesn't wake you up. It doesn't change anything for you.
Google invented this, didn't they?
It's kind of like the Inspire to some degree, right?
I have no idea.
And the Inspire, like a little shock.
That is, it's Inspire. The Inspire device is a hypoglossal nerve stimulator.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. The interesting thing so far is that there's very strict parameters for a patient with sleep apnea to be a candidate for the Inspire device.
Will medical insurance get payment for adults to get some of this orthognathic surgery you're talking about?
Yes. Okay. Especially on the level of obstructive sleep apnea, knowing that it's a deadly disease.
Wow.
You know, as long as
they have to meet criteria, probably.
They have to meet criteria. Yeah, but medical insurance, I mean, the vast majority of corrective jaw surgery I do is covered under medical
and insurance. And so almost all of this will be in most hospitals or surgeons that are doing this are doing it in a hospital setting.
Right.
They're going to be in network. So some of these.
Yeah, someone like me, my practice is very much insurance, medical insurance heavy. So yeah, I'm in network with a significant
number. How much of the focus providers. Is being driven on like growth and development and trying to avoid that, like going down even into.
Yeah, so that's
early,
an area that
early or 6 to 8 years old.
Yeah,
or even going, we can go even back to infants now and tongue ties and what they're mm-hmm. you know starting to see from that standpoint.
You know, I still have a big bias because we just don't have enough literature for me
like
to
myofunctional even therapy yeah, and some of that you know, stuff.
The academic names coming out.
Yeah,
I don't have 30 years of literature, so I will wait 30 years until
well,
the new
techniques
develop.
So it's funny because I've had people argue with me.
That's a huge thing. Like that's a huge
jaw
market
surgery,
right now.
Jaw surgery doesn't work. You know, I've had people tell me that, and it's just like, all right. So, you know, so myofunctional therapy, I think it's still in its infancy. I cannot support it just because I don't see it.
Sure.
Even in the children's hospital I work at,
That's not a common thing.
Yeah, it's not a common thing. You know, and
there's a huge market, obviously, holistically outside of that approach building.
And this is where I turn into the jerk and say, you know, because people are getting paid for tongue ties, I see it tongue ties being every kid needs a tongue ties app. You know, needs a lingophrenectomy.
Of course they do.
I don't buy it, but, you know.
But the flip side of that is that's also what drives progression and that there's obviously some truth to some of that, right? Or
the answer is yes.
I think there
he's
is.
Not going to say yes because he doesn't have the literature to back
it up. Right, that's something. But we
so I can see my mom getting angry right now because we're getting ready to start that conversation.
I like that. That's why we're here, right?
You know,
to have that kind of conversation.
If there's a legitimate large frenum, yes, there's no doubt about it in my mind that frenectomy should be done. I know people who are going around
basically
cutting
says
tongues
we're pushing the limits for money. Is what he said.
I'm worried
some
about. I'm not saying I'm saying.
Some
for
sure.
I'm worried about that. It's a concern. You know, so yeah, in my practice, do I do frenectomies? Of course. And I see a lot of patients who come in who need a frenectomy. But there are moms who come in who say, my baby's not latching very well.
It's a huge thing. Huge thing right now.
You know, and I can't promise them that doing a frenectomy is going to change that.
No,
there's
but it's
so
the first
many
choice.
Animals. Well, if there's not
a choice.
It's a choice, but if not, the anatomy's not jumping out at you to say that this is probably a problem.
So there's cases where... may say, I don't think it's necessary to do.
There are cases where I've hesitated to say that I think that this will benefit you. The hard part to say is there a downside to doing it? There's not a ton of risk.
Oh, sure.
But
crying
to be
baby
honest,
for 30 seconds. Yeah.
Right. Crying baby for a couple, 30 seconds and that's it. But I can't promise anyone that if I don't see in my eyes, I judge that there's an anatomic problem that zapping, cutting the frenum is going to make a difference.
Yeah.
But again, you know, my mind works based on having some legitimate science behind things and not a key opinion leader who's just kind of made it up.
I get that.
Why are you looking at me?
We've had this before.
But on one hand, that's a hard thing because on one hand, you're exactly right. If we always went off what literature said, there would be little progression.
We'd still be doing amalgams.
Exactly. So we have to be progressive. We have to think differently. And there's got
to
be.
We have to accept people, a group of people pushing the limits. Because that's when progress.
Yeah, everything's going back to science. Everything's on a bell curve, right? So you have people who are way far behind. You have people who are way far pushing things ahead, and then you have people who just fall in the middle. So, I don't have enough to talk about lingual frenectomy from the oral facial myology side and the sleep apnea side and
it makes sense too, being where you are at in your position, dealing with what you do. You're probably you got to fall more into the middle of the bell curve.
Yeah. And
in
I
a hospital setting based on medical insurance, you're going to be in the middle.
That's
of
what
the
I'm
bell
saying.
Curve.
I think that's okay.
Maybe towards the back.
Whereas
of the bell
you,
curve.
As a private practitioner, have the opportunity to potentially
to seek out people that are willing to go outside of medical insurance, basically
be on the further end of that. Yeah.
So it's just something that and we also there's always a medical legal side of things too. So that's always in the back of the mind that you have to be cognizant.
And the bean counters are definitely aware of that.
Always.
The suits, as I like to call them.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this has been fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I
can't believe
here,
I've been doing this podcast 4 years and haven't had him on. I want to say how proud I am of you, other than the fact that you live in D.C. and that you work at a hospital. But other than that, you're unbelievably knowledgeable,
And I reciprocate. I think the team that you've built and you guys are working together on, it's what dentistry needs. I wish that
You mean we need less wows and nachos?
Huh? He's like, what's funny is he's living in a world that totally doesn't have nachos and wows. That's why we know he's doing it right.
I have no idea what he's talking about. But, you know, it's, you know, dental education. There's something about dental education that has to change, especially on the dental school side. And this is kind of what a young, someone who's coming out needs, is a group of people who are passionate or interested in pushing it and saying, get educated. That's what I love about it.
And make it fun.
Yeah. Make it, you know, well, whatever it takes to get someone.
And if I can encourage you, we would love to have you, and I hope he will pay you good money to come. No, and I'll make sure.
It's been the running joke for a long time. I know.
So are you going to help me with serious. The DIC program?
I think one, we need you to come for the DIC program, the dental implant continuum that we're starting in 2020. And sleep too needs you. I think we would all benefit from this kind of sleep knowledge to know this perspective and know what's out there.
And I'm happy to talk about it.
So I'll tell you what, here's what we'll do on the sleep side. Me, you, and Aaron will get on a Zoom call, a Skype call, and we'll have a conversation because she definitely has better questions to ask than I do.
White T-Bone has to be there.
Yeah, I got to be there, right? Well, what about me?
Oh, skinny white T-Bone and short.
I'm excited that you called me skinny. That's good.
Well, compared to me,
wife's going to be pumped that someone called me skinny this weekend.
Compared to me and Robbie, certainly that is. So, Robbie, how can people get in touch with you?
That's always
RobbieDDS@gmail.com.
Yeah, I guess you can throw my personal email out there.
No offense, Robbie, but it wasn't that hard to figure out. It really, that's original. Let's be personal.
Well, it was, you know, it used to be Taggerwall DDS.
I just use it.
But I followed suit. I'm not the creative one. I'm the creative. Yeah. I just follow
and
suit.
You work at the MedStar Washington Hospital Center.
Correct. Yeah.
In Washington, D.C. You can certainly find him there.
Well, I'd be the first one to say, if you're an oral surgeon or if you're...
Oh, yeah, his birthday is October 1983.
But if you're a young dentist... Biodata. Because obviously we have a huge group of people who are either...
Biodata, slightly weakest complexion.
Y'all are ridiculous. Anywho, as I was saying,
very homely, professional.
If you are a young dentist who is either right out of school, trying to figure out something, or you're trying to figure out, hey, does it make sense to go into residency? I would totally reach out to him,
slightly balding,
and pick his brain to see what's going on.
100%. I mean, anybody who's interested in oral surgery, by all means, reach out, and I'll tell you the good side.
So
of
let
it.
Me. I got to end on this.
All
okay?
right,
I got to end on this. Okay, so you were just here last week, wasn't it, or the week before? 2 weeks ago. Yeah. So he came in and I'm like, so I'm doing the political thing. I'm like, so Robbie, listen, so if I have a friend that I want to get an interview, can you just make that happen for me? And he's like, well, not exactly. I'm like, but aren't you program director? I'm like, he's like, well, you know, it doesn't quite work that way. I'm like, so if I needed a favor, you couldn't get that for me.
No, it's not even that. He said, well, no, let me just rephrase it. If I want to do all surgery, can I come to your program? And I was like,
like, I just come in right now.
Can you get me into your program? And I was like, definitely not.
Let me be very clear. Like, you are not qualified.
What kind of brother wouldn't get their own brother a spot in a program that, in theory, you run?
And when he said that, I said, well, I can lean people some ways, but I can't promise that you're going to get in.
And not to mention that he'd probably be like, well, this guy, he's going to have his own motives, his own ideas, and he's going to listen to anything that literature has to say.
And then he said, well, don't you think I'll be a good candidate? And I was like, I don't think you're ready to work 80 hours a week and not sleep.
Or ready to work for someone else. That's the big one.
For education, you would. But you know,
maybe.
At this point in his career, I'd like to see that.
Maybe. Love you, Ravi.
I appreciate it. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, hey, if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and check out the T-Bone Speaks podcast. leave us a 5-star review.
And you also need to check out the Millennial Dentist podcast.
You should.
And leave them a 4-star review.
Yeah, 4.5, 5-star. We appreciate that. But hey, everybody, work smarter, not harder. We love you.
Where did you learn that from?
Come check us out at 3ddentist.com. We'd love to have you at our courses, and we will see you next time.